and a very warm welcome to No Heathen Land, a podcast retelling macabre, intriguing, and just plain weird stories from the past, from God's own country, Yorkshire. In my opinion, Yorkshire is the perfect breeding ground for the most weird and wonderful tales. In Yorkshire, we have the rolling, vast countryside of the dales, dark, tangled woodlands, remote back roads, but also industry, hard labour, a history of staunch religion, farming, tight-knit communities, immigration, a welcoming attitude, intolerance, riots. Much of this documented, a vast amount not. It's the stories in between the newspaper headlines that I really want to get into. Through my experience working in local history, it's really quite surprising how many odd tales you come across simply by looking into one single person's family history, for example. A newspaper article, a diary entry, a theatre playbill, a photograph. I'm very lucky to have made friendships and connections with interesting and enthusiastic people right here in Yorkshire. Each episode will feature one of them as a very special guest, where we'll delve into some of the stories we've come across that have fascinated, baffled, and sometimes unnerved us. Because of the subject nature of this podcast, some stories will not be suitable for everyone. Approach with caution. Hello, and welcome to episode 2 of No Heathen Land. First off, I wanted to say thank you so much to anyone who listened to episode 1. I had an unexpected amount of people listening, and it was just amazing and affirming. And thank you to the people who messaged me to say they enjoyed the episode and to ask me questions. Honestly, I'm just so grateful that people listened and wanted to chat about the stories. It's just made me even more excited to put out more episodes. So, new episode, new guest. Today we have my friend Josh Flint. Josh is an ex-primary school teacher and he came to the local and family history library that I worked in a few years ago, and we ended up in the same job together. Josh is an absolute delight and one of the sweetest people I know, always having time for anyone that he meets. Josh is a history enthusiast with a penchant for the War of the Roses, which I will be inviting him back onto the podcast to talk about later, I hope. He's flourished in local history research, as you'll hear from the story he's chosen to enthusiastically share. Once again, listen to the end for information on where to find out more about the research sources for this podcast and more. Here we go, episode 2. Okay, hi Josh.
Hi Sally.
Welcome to No Heathen Land. So I just need to pretend that we've not been talking for the past hour. How are you doing today?
Oh, all right, yeah. How's your day been?
It's been absolutely excellent, especially the last hour that we've been chatting.
That's definitely been the best part of the day.
Yeah. So as this podcast goes on, I'm just going to be having one guest. So today I'm not telling a story, but Josh is going to tell a story. But first, I just wanted to sort of introduce Josh and say how we met. So how did we meet, Josh?
So we both worked at the library.
We did.
But I technically only got there because you did a year-long stint with History Pin.
Oh, yeah.
So the only reason there was a job vacancy at the library, which the only reason I got in there, which was because you got this kind of additional job for a year, which kind of allowed that to happen, which was amazing.
Yeah, so I did a project job. Was that 2016?
Yes.
Was
it? November. Well, yeah.
Well-remembered me that did that job. Yeah, and that's how we met. And then after that, we ended up doing the same job, didn't we? So we were both, I'm going to say assistant librarians, because anything else just makes it complicated, doesn't it? Then we'd have to explain exactly what we did.
Yeah, we're also managers as well, which is terrifying.
Yeah, so we were both assistant librarians, local and family history librarians, so that's how we met.
And Sally taught me everything that I know. Yeah.
That's so nice. Well. And that's why Josh doesn't know anything. Yeah, and I'm already going to premise this, I think, before we start, but Josh is one of the nicest people ever, I think, that I've ever met. Can you accept that compliment?
I accept it and I'm putting it in my back pocket.
Okay.
So, Josh's story today, I only know a tiny bit about it, and I have heard this story, but it was within a talk about the place where it's set. So, can you tell us where the story is set, and do you want to tell us why you chose this story?
Okay, so I'm going to be talking about the murder and haunting at the Malt Mill from 1854. And the reason why I chose this is because I live in Armley, which is a town in Leeds, and I decided to do a local history talk about the history of Armley. But instead of picking on, like, you know, what you'd normally find, which is maps or big industrial lands or anything like that, I thought I'd choose, like, interesting stories that I could find. And then this one jumped out at me, because I was reading the, you know, it was a history of Armley book, which is, it's probably one of the bigger inner city town, inner towns of Leeds.
I'd say so, yeah.
And so there's quite a lot of things that's kind of changed throughout history and that kind of stuff. But yeah, so I was reading the history of Armley book, and the title of this story is called The Murder of the Malt Mill, and it's took place in Armley, on the Armley Town Street, which is the main street where all the shops are throughout Armley. It's the kind of the hub of the area to a certain extent. It still is now. But this kind of really gruesome and this kind of event happened there, and this, and from there it's kind of spawned all these kind of urban legends and haunting theories and things like that, which I think odd, and you know, odd stories do in these smaller places. They kind of take hold a little bit, don't they?
Yeah. So, with this story, why did you choose this to go along with all your other Armley tales? Because I know within that talk that I listened to about Armley, it was so interesting, but there's so much in there. And do you think that Armley is unique in Leeds, or do you think the other places match up? Do you think that you would be interested in Armley history if you didn't live there and recognise it?
Ooh, interesting. Well, I mean, for me, because I'm personally from Nottingham, not even from Yorkshire, I know I shouldn't say it.
Very scandalous.
Exactly.
And I think you are the... So, Josh is the second person that I'm interviewing for this podcast. I don't know if you're going to be the second episode, we'll see. But my first guest, Ross, also isn't from Yorkshire.
Yeah.
So the first two people that I chose to be on this podcast aren't even from Yorkshire. It's
I don't know what that says
scandalous.
About exactly. But for me, because I'm from Nottingham and then I moved to Armley in about 2018, I kind of started to delve into Leeds history through the prism of Armley to a certain extent, rather than the city centre. So for me, a lot of Armley history is kind of wrapped up into the bigger Leeds city history.
Mm-hmm.
And especially because it's so close to the centre, I feel like kind of Armley is kind of a microcosm of what's going on in the bigger areas around it. And so to find these kind of interesting stories of kind of Armley during the Industrial Revolution, how people kind of start to live there and kind of, you know, kill people there as well. No spoilers. It brings a new life to that area, which you don't normally get from maps, or you don't get from, you know, trade directories or electoral rolls, those kind of other things that we would be more generally using in the local and family history department. These kind of stories really kind of give a sense of what Armley was like at the time. And I'm not really here to say Armley's better than other places, even though it totally is. but for me, it's really important because that was my in into the history of Leeds.
Yeah, okay. So, as a person that doesn't know that much about Armley, apart from what you've told me, and you know what I've heard in various jobs that I've done, what do you think is the main thing that people think of when they think of Armley? The first thing.
Yeah, I mean, the first thing people think is Armley Mills, or probably Gotts Park as well. Gotts Park, Armley Mills, and probably the asbestos scandal.
I can think of one other thing.
Go on then.
It's got big prison in it.
Oh gosh, yeah.
That was my first thought. Yeah. Okay. Well, yours are much nicer.
Yeah. As soon as you think of Armley, you think of the jail. Yep, that's great.
Yeah. But in a historical context, what would you like people to take away from your version of Armley? So what do you think is the most important thing about Armley?
I mean, the nice thing that I found about this story, which we'll go into in a second, is that it's the togetherness that you find from the people of Armley, that's all kind of building around the church, and it's building around, you know, how this kind of horrific incident brought the people of Armley together, which to me was the real silver lining of the story, is that it brings the people together, but also through kind of myths and mythologizing the story to a certain extent, it kind of makes that means that people aren't being forgotten, which I think again shows this kind of togetherness from this kind of at this point in the 1850s, a small town, kind of that's kind of just on the rise to a certain extent.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That's really interesting. So, do you want to start your story and tell me? Didn't you say you've got a title for your story?
Yes. Okay. So,
I'm ready. Let's go.
Yes. Yeah, so my title is "The Murder and the Haunting of Malt Mill." But my opening line, was the main thing, was that like every good Yorkshire story, this one starts in Lancashire.
Uh-huh. Exactly. I'm going to lose, if anyone listened to the first episode, I'm going to have lost them now.
Thanks so much. I'm sure saying I was from Nottingham's probably lost them already. So this story starts in 1854, and it really starts a few years before that, and it's all centred around this person called Jane Banham. And so Jane was originally from Manchester, and she was born in 1828, and she always wanted to be a dancer. And she then started to travel around the country to be a dancer. And she got married to William Banham. Obviously, her married name is Banham. And he was also a dancer, and he actually ran away from her and her marriage to go to Australia to become a dancer there on his own. Wow. I know, exactly.
And that is in the 1800s?
1850s.
Oh, my goodness. I just imagine, like, I mean, I know that ships were going all around the world then and people were going all over, but I just imagine, like, the length of time it must have taken to get to, like, Australia. I mean, I don't know if you've watched it, but did you watch The Terror recently?
No, I didn't, no.
Oh, okay, well, I definitely recommend that you watch it. I'm definitely going to talk about that with another guest then that I know has watched it, but, I mean, that's made me never want to go on a ship ever again, so...
Yeah, I feel like Titanic did that for me.
Oh, yeah.
Every ship.
Is that too?
Exactly, yeah. Every ship, I always think of... I don't go on boats very often, but I always think of Titanic. Okay. And, whenever I kind of get on a ship and it's not, like, as big and extravagant as Titanic, you're slightly kind of... You're like, well, if that sank, how's this gonna float?
Yeah, true. Anyway, please continue.
Yes. Okay, so this story starts in the 1850s, and Jane's just been left by her husband, and she... now really just wants to become a dancer. And so she moves to she moves in with this kind of producer, this entertainment producer called John Hannah, and they're effectively husband and wife, even though they can't get married because obviously she's married to someone else who's run away for the time being, and they have two children together. But what Jane's finding during these kind of early years of being together and having children is that John is really stopping her from being a dancer. And so what she does, out of pretty much nowhere, she just leaves him and moves to Leeds. She moves to Armley, and she becomes takes her two children with her, and she becomes a part of the Armley dance societies, and she becomes a really prominent dancer in Armley and the rest of Leeds, and pretty much a lot of West Yorkshire as well. She did quite a lot in Halifax and Batley and places like that. But obviously the problem is for Jane is that she's taken the two children away from their father. And so at some point, John was going to find out where they were. Mm-hmm. And it didn't take them too long. And it all kind of ends on this fateful morning on the 11th of September, 1854. And Jane has started to become quite successful as a dancer at the time. She's now living there with her father, John, another John. And her two children, who are now 3 and about 1.5, 18 months old.
Are they also called John?
Also called John, yep. Two girls called John. So they're living there. She's starting to get more successful and everything's kind of going great. And then her ex-partner, John Hannah, then turns up in Leeds. And he's starting to ask questions about where she is. Mm. And he's trying to find out where she is. Under the guise of really what he wants to do is to take her back to Manchester with the two children.
Okay.
And so on the 11th of September, 1854, Jane is in the malt mill in Armley. And it's midday. She's going there in for early afternoon, for lunch, for a couple of drinks before she performs that evening with the two children and her father. You know, just kind of a nice day out. And we know from the trial, spoiler, we know from what happens later that John has visited lots of other pubs to try and work out where Jane is in Armley, he's kind of narrowed down where she is. And he finds her at the malt mill. And he pulls Jane to one side with her father, and he says, "You have to come back to Manchester." And she says, "Absolutely not. I'm doing really well here. I'm not. And the kids are staying with me," which is great. And John can't accept this, and he is kind of starting to get more and more aggressive. And what we later know is that he's actually really, really drunk by this point as well, even at midday in early September. I was going to say the day then. I was going to say Wednesday. I'm not entirely sure why. It just seems like a Wednesday to me.
Let's say it was a Wednesday.
So on this Wednesday, it was... So the father is so kind of frustrated with what's going on with Jane and John that he just leaves them to it. He says, "Go into the parlour of the malt mill. I'll take the two children out of the way. You two just have to discuss this and go from there." About 2 minutes later, there's a scream from Jane from within the parlour, and the person who owns the malt mill runs in, and Jane is lying on the floor with her throat slit.
Oh my goodness.
And there's no one else in the room whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the room, apparently, from what this says, doesn't have any windows and doesn't have any doors, so no one actually knows how he got out. However, a busy pub, you know, he probably just left. John just probably left the.
So she's just there on her own on the floor, and he's not there.
Yes. So they get into the room. She's there. There's blood everywhere. She's lying down. Her throat's been slit, and there's no one else with her. And people already assume who's probably done it, because people saw him. Mm-hmm. Saw John and Jane go into the parlour together, and obviously this horrific incident happened. So what happens is that the landlord calls for two surgeons to come and try and help Jane, and also sends off a couple of people that works behind the bar to go and find this John. And the two surgeons get to Jane, they look at her wounds, and they realise that she's been slit from ear to ear.
Oof.
Yeah. And the throat cut has been so deep that it's actually cut part of her spine.
Oh, yeah. Oh.
We did have a conversation about this. Like, should I actually go into too much detail? And Sally said it was okay, so...
Yeah, it's okay. Everything will have a content warning, it'll be fine. But, that's so nasty.
It's awful, exactly.
Yeah.
So Jane is obviously not in a good way at all. And the surgeons look at her wounds... and say, "There's not really much we can do, to be honest. You're just going to die." And so they don't take her to hospital. They don't even put her into a bed. They put her on a chair in the parlour. And they're just kind of, you know, just saying, you're not going to last much longer. Just sit here and just go from there.
So she was alive?
She was alive, exactly.
Oh, that's even worse. Yeah.
So they do this, and she's alive while they're just trying to sort out whether they can help her or not. Mm-hmm. And conscious. As well.
How?
So she's losing blood, she's conscious, and she knows she's going to be die soon, because that's what she's been told.
Gosh.
And also she knows that they can't do anything.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't make Armley sound great so far, I must admit.
Look, it's not the fault of the place.
Exactly, yeah. And also remember that these two people came from Manchester as well, so, you know, yeah. So I don't know what that tells you. So they end up finding John Hannah, and he's actually got all the way to the asylum's land around the asylum just outside of Armley, and so he's about a couple of miles away from where the malt mill was. And so these kind of barmen, they grab him, and he's got blood-stained clothes to a certain extent, and they take him back to the malt mill, and they have him in handcuffs, well, what, you know, probably just rope, binding his hands together.
I don't know, they probably had handcuffs then, sure.
Probably. In my mind, they don't, but, you know.
Look it up.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. have, like, one of those, like, inserts things saying,
"Yeah,
Sally, did they have handcuffs there?" And you can say yes or no.
Local history fairy.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Love it. So they drag him to Jane, who's still alive at this point, and by this point, there's a big crowd around, just like seeing what's happened in the malt mill. And Jane's still there, still conscious, still sitting on this chair, still dying. Surgeon still won't do anything. And they bring John Hannah to her. And the surgeon, well, the barman and the surgeon go to Jane and say, "Is this the person that killed you?" and she can't speak, obviously, because her throat's been cut. So what they say is nod once for yes and twice for no, and she nods once and then dies.
Does she nod? Is that second nod the death?
Well, maybe the first one's the death. All we know is that she nodded once, yeah, and then she lost consciousness and died. And what Jane was effectively doing, she was being the star witness at her own murder trial. Which, obviously, it raises the questions of, was she actually going to nod again before she became unconscious and died? But what that nod was sufficient enough to as evidence against John Hannah.
I should flip it up, so.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah.
As if, like, so you've got a woman that's had her throat cut down to the spine, and they're like, oh, just don't, like, raise your hand or anything. Nod.
Yeah, nod.
With your broken neck.
Yeah, and nod
that
twice.
Seems really harsh.
Exactly.
Okay, okay.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So that's the gory stuff out of the way.
Okay.
So then Jane dies, and this is the reason why I chose this story about Armley, is because what happens next, really. So we'll get on to what happened with the trial of John Hannah. But what I found more really interesting is that the people of Armley knew that Jane wasn't from there. And her father, John, another John, her father, John, was trying to decide whether to bury her in St. Bartholomew's Church in Graveyard in Armley or take her back to Manchester.
Mm.
And he decided in the end, because she had such a successful start to her career in Armley, and because she felt like home there, he said, we're going to bury her at St. Bartholomew's. But he wants to keep the funeral really, really kind of intimate and quiet. But because the shock and the awe of what happened to Jane really kind of created tremors around Armley, so many people arrived at the St. Bartholomew's for the burial that the priest or the vicar, it would be a vicar. The vicar complained afterwards that all these people were trampling over other graves because they were just trying to get close to Jane and send their condolences to the family. And I think to me that kind of shows how this togetherness of what this kind of horrific act has done for the people of Armley is that they kind of stood in solidarity against this kind of horrific act,
yeah.
Which I think is quite an interesting testament to the people there at the time.
Yeah, definitely.
And it was when I read that, I was like, that's something where you can kind of see it today to a certain extent as well, you know, when certain crimes and when certain things kind of have a public consciousness to a certain extent and public grieving. And I feel like you can really see how that's happened back then as well.
Yeah.
So a couple of weeks later, the trial of John Hannah took place. And on the trial, there's 12 people on the jury, three of which worked with Jane in the dance studios, which I'm not entirely sure is completely right, but
yeah, I mean, I'm guessing that became law later on that you couldn't have people that, like,
yeah,
definitely not directly knew them. You can't even, like, watch the news now if you go to if you're a juror, can you? Like,
exactly, yeah. Yeah, they vet you. Exactly, yeah. So three of the 12 already had some contact with Jane, which is interesting. Interestingly, more than that, is the fact that the trial was held at the Malt Mill.
Oh.
So the place where she was killed, that's where the trial was actually held. Which, again, doesn't really seem like it would fly today.
Nah, probably not. I think that might have been fairly common, though, to have it in the pub, wasn't it? Because that was,
yeah,
like, the hub for the community. There's so many of them. Probably quite a lot of crimes went on in pubs.
Exactly.
I would imagine, too.
I
don't know if you look this up, but do you know how many, like, public houses there were in Armley at that time? So this is like 1850. I bet there were,
yeah,
a lot.
Oh, I bet there was a lot, especially on the town street. And, yeah, you know, if you look at maps of Armley in that time period, it really kind of really bursts into life.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why you get, yeah, you'd find many a pub.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. So the main, so John Hannah's on trial for the murder of Jane Banham. He says he's not guilty. The evidence against him is the nod from Jane, and also the fact he was the last person who was seen with her, and also the fact that he was covered in blood when they found him. From what the defence really relies on the fact that this was a crime of passion. They don't even try and say that, even though John says that he wasn't guilty, the defence are so, they know that's not going to work. Mm-hmm. And so they go with this kind of idea that he loved her so much that he could, if he couldn't have her, he was going to kill her, which is horrible, obviously, but not an uncommon defence as well, which is really interesting.
I mean, I don't know if you're going to come onto this, but was the fact that she took the children brought into this, or was it just that he loved her so much they couldn't let her go, and not the fact that she took the children and moved away?
I found a couple of newspaper articles on this from the time period, and what they kind of say is that he wanted to use the children as a bargaining chip to get her back. And so he was willing to take one of the children back to Manchester on the provision that she had to come back every other weekend to see them.
No.
Exactly. Okay. So it's like entrapment. Mm. And I feel like that, again, goes against him because the children are not a priority. They don't seem to be a priority. He just seems fixated on this, on Jane. And he, during the trial, kind of completely breaks down every time he's interviewed. They can't even use any of his witness testimony because he is either talking to himself, which could mean other things, or he's just crying out loud. He's saying he's not guilty. That's it. So it doesn't really take them long. It takes them 20 minutes to find him guilty, and then he gets sent to Armley Jail, which obviously Sally loves about Armley.
It's my number one destination in
exactly, Armley. Exactly, yeah. I knew it. So he's taken to Armley Jail and he's later executed. But the reason why I find this story so fascinating is because that's not the end of Jane. Years later, in the malt mill, and when that gets knocked down, it becomes the Royal House, a Royal Hotel in Armley. There's stories of this woman who is always constantly there at the dead of night, dressed in grey, even though there shouldn't be anyone else in the pub. And what the people who worked there used to call this person, this woman, this youngish woman, dressed in grey. Oh, that's just Jane. That's just Jane. That's just Jane Banham. She's always with us.
That's so creepy.
And so from 1854 up until 1930, there's different testimonies of people seeing this grey woman.
Wow.
Up until the Royal Hotel when it was knocked down. And I just find that so interesting because, again, it shows how this kind of mythologizing of what this horrific incident, but how normally what would happen after this is that the people who get murdered get forgotten.
Yeah.
And I really appreciate the fact that Jane hasn't been forgotten and that she's now part of Armley folklore.
Yeah.
And how she's kind of living on through that.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think, again, shows the power of the people of Armley at the time, and also the power that Jane had in herself and the influence that she caused, not just from her death, obviously, but from the gravitas that she had during her life to bring people together to a certain extent.
Mm. I think there's a bit of a misconception sometimes that especially women in the Victorian period, in that mid-1800s, were just sort of like tied down and had to be married and never went anywhere and just didn't, you know, they did whatever the husbands would say. But actually that's not really true. People did manage to get away from marriages that, I mean, in this case, it sounds like it wasn't going very well. You know, if that's the first time that he was incredibly abusive and he obviously killed her, then that's a big shock, you know, to leave the city that you live in and go to, you know, an hour away. An hour away in the 1850s is a long, long way. On your own with two children, you know, how did she know how she was going to be perceived? She didn't know if she was going to get any work. She sounds like quite an interesting woman. And it must have been a bad marriage, you know, especially if her father, who was in the story, was supporting her while she was there.
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things to really pick up on there. I think it's, the first one is that, yes, you're completely right. There's a complete misconception about what the role of women in the 19th century. I mean, like I say, just Jane moving from, you know, Lancashire to Yorkshire is, you know, it's not unheard of at the time, but we would assume it is unheard of.
Yeah.
And then just this woman who had two children and then still trying to become her dream of being a dancer and becoming successful. It's something that's like, it's a Hollywood film, isn't it? It's not, you don't really think of it as a 1850 story from Armley in Leeds. Mm. And I feel like, again, it's probably one of the reasons why this story grabbed me so much is because, yes, the takeaway is the horrific murder and the haunting, but Jane sounds so fascinating, and her life in the 26 years she was around for, she just packed that with so much. Like, you know, even the first husband running away to Australia. Yeah. You know, what a ridiculous thing to happen at that time period.
Because if she was only 26, that's so young.
Exactly, yeah. And you just, you know, and it's the real sadness of what could she have become if she was, you know, would she be on the playbills that we have at the Leeds Central Library, being a dancer? You know, could she have been that person, that performer? And I feel like that's the horror of all this, is that we just won't ever know.
Yeah, that's such a fantastic story. Thank you. So I was going to ask, is it the malt mill?
Malt mill, yeah.
What is there now? Do we know?
So it's still a pub on Armley Town Street, and I cannot remember.
So was it knocked down and rebuilt then?
It was knocked down and rebuilt into the Royal Hotel. Yeah. And then that building is now under a different name, and the name of that guy, I can't remember.
We can find out, and I'll put it in the notes. Yeah. So we can have a look.
But that's always quite nice. It's a bit further up on Town Street than, say, where the hub of Town Street is now, but it's still a very beautiful building at the time. Yeah. Yeah, there's a couple of really nice photographs on leodis.net as well.
Yeah. I can link those as well. Yeah. But I'll put them in the notes.
Yeah, and the nice thing is that we've got a really nice photograph of the malt mill from 1904, just before it was knocked down to become the Royal Hotel. Oh, wow. And it looks like I would believe ghosts live there, put it that way.
Jane's presence was there.
Jane's, exactly, yeah. So if you ever go into a pub in Armley and you see a grey shadowy figure, then, you know, you might meet Jane.
Okay, so just to lighten the mood a little bit, I'm going to be doing, with all my guests, a Culture Corner. Mm. So I was going to do a jingle, but I haven't, so it's just Culture Corner.
Nice.
So it's just basically to sort of lighten the mood a bit after each story, because some of these stories are a little bit spooky, a little bit horrible, so it's just to lighten it up a little bit. So I just want to ask my guests, sort of like, what have they been watching, reading? Have they been to the cinema? You know, because now we can go to the cinema again in England. So yeah, is there anything that you'd like to share? I've got a couple of things that I can talk about this week.
Yes. So I was actually off work for a week, which is just, you know, lovely. And I decided to watch a couple of films. And the first one was Cruella, which was long but really, really great.
Yeah.
Like, if you're ever interested in anything to do with fashion, it's just in kind of grungy fashion as well. It's absolutely brilliant. So and Emma Stone is wonderful. So
cool, tick.
And Emma Thompson as well is so horrible, but so kind of a scene stealer.
Who does she play in it?
She plays the big villain. So Cruella obviously is the villain of 101 Dalmatians. And so they don't make her good, but they make someone worse, which is just hilarious.
The really villainous characters are always the best, though, aren't they? Yeah.
And I also watch, which doesn't lighten the mood at all, but I also watch Promising Young Woman, which is a Carey Mulligan film, and, well, she stars in it, and that is absolutely brilliant. Horrific, but oddly, you know, it's down as a dark comedy, and I think that's kind of, that's exactly what it is. Mm-hmm. It's horrific, but also really, it's oddly funny, and there's lots of Paris Hilton songs in there, which is
right up your street.
Exactly, I love it. Yeah.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Anything else that you would like to
share? And I've just started watching Pose as well.
Oh, so do you think that I'd watch this?
Yes.
I haven't.
Have you not? Okay, well, I'm not going to talk about it then, because otherwise I'll ruin it.
Well, that's one of those series that literally everyone that's watched it has been like, you've got to watch it because you'll love it. And I'm sure I will. There's so much stuff that I've just not got around to. But yeah, Pose is on the list. There's been several of my friends that have said, I can't believe you haven't watched it.
Mm.
So
Pose is really, really great. And it's the only problem with Pose is that the episode's about an hour and a half.
Oh, that's and quite long, isn't it?
So you always feel like, you know, I always remember watching the Twin Peaks opening, the pilot for Twin Peaks, and that's like a 2-hour film. And you just, there's so much in it that you kind of
I know, you
feel like it's going to be a mammoth every time you want to try and rewatch it.
I keep meaning to go back and watch the second series, and maybe the first as well, but definitely the second, because I feel like there's just so much going on in, this is Twin Peaks, by the way.
Yeah.
That I still don't really feel like I know what happened in the second series.
Oh, so you don't want to talk about it too much because there's so many spoilers in it, but there the are. Second season of Twin Peaks is absolutely incredible. But then it's one of those where the first half of the second season is incredible, and then it just kind of... I'll stop there.
Yeah, it goes... it's weird anyway, isn't it? But it goes, like, super weird.
Crazily weird. and then the finale is just absolutely ridiculous.
Yeah.
But I've never seen the newest seasons.
I haven't seen it either. I've heard mixed things. Mm. I've heard amazing, and I've also heard, like, dog shit.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Lovely.
It's definitely, again, on my massive list of things to find time to do.
Yeah, I did recently watch the Twin Peaks film again as well, Fire Walk With Me,
mm-hmm.
and that is actually Promising Woman reminded me of that film quite a lot. This kind of inevitable horror in a woman's life kind of thing, and but again, the Fire Walk With Me is probably the scariest thing I've ever watched. But I'm completely terrified of angels, and so...
Terrified of angels?
Yeah, terrified of apps. Anything to do with, like, Christian imagery. Really? And it's not because my partner's Catholic, that's fine. But angels and God and the devil, less so. But
yeah, he's cooler.
Yeah, exactly, he's fine. But yes, I think it's because I watched The Omen when I was too young.
Oh, yeah,
and quite worrying. Yeah, and... and then, so whenever I see anything but angels, like, I'm terrified.
I don't think I knew this about you, Josh. I've known you for quite a long time now. Well, this is a new thing that I can put in my scaring Josh.
Exactly, yeah. Dress up as an angel.
Yeah. Yeah, it's good about wearing this outfit today and not my angel outfit.
Yeah.
So the thing that I wanted to mention was that I watched Time on the BBC.
Oh,
it was like a 3-part drama. And I haven't met anyone that's watched it yet, but it's so good. So it's got Sean Bean in it. Oh, I just had to look at it with my phone, like, looking at it. So I couldn't remember what the other guy was called. It's Sean Bean, who is the main character. And the other main character is played by Stephen Graham, who is, like, a super famous Scouse actor. He's in, like, any good British drama. And I think I've not really seen Sean Bean in that much, apart from, obviously, Game of Thrones.
And Lord of the Rings.
And, yeah, I don't think everyone remembers him for those, like, huge characters. But this is quite different. He's... still Yorkshire, obviously.
Yeah.
So this is good for this podcast. It's on theme. But basically, he, without giving any spoilers away, he gets sent to prison for something. And he was formerly a teacher.
Oh.
So he's very mild-mannered. And, you know, like, he's not set up for this prison, which is full of, you know, people half his age that are incredibly terrifying. And then Stephen Graham plays one of the prison wardens, called prison wardens, prison guards. A difficult job. And there's another story going on with him and his son,
mm-hmm.
who is in a different prison. And there's lots of logistics going on around that, and then it's how their stories intertwine a little bit. But it's like, it's kind of like two separate stories. It's just, it's so good. It's just one of those dramas that is just so well done. You know, it's just 3 episodes, limited. Not going to be any more, because it need to be. And I really like that. When it's just done and dusted.
Mm.
The ending wasn't my favourite thing ever, but I don't know how they would have ended it another way that would satisfy everyone, I don't think. But it's definitely worth watching. I can't tell you what happened in the end. it's a really good watch. And because it is only 3 episodes, you can kind of, like, watch them all at once on a Sunday, maybe. It's very, very good. If you like gritty British dramas, which I do.
Me too, yes. Yeah. Yeah, you recommended. Yes, the last BBC drama you recommended was Dracula, which was...
Well, some people had mixed reviews of that, though. I loved it so much.
First episode was amazing. Second one was great. The third one was a mess. I've never seen anything like it. Like, I was so excited for the third episode, and I'm not going to give any spoilers away, but it was just the weirdest and...
Yeah.
Yeah. It was crazy.
Basically, if you haven't seen it, it, like, jumps through time, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's in modern day.
Yeah, so the first episode is set in the 1800s, mm-hmm. and then it jumps again to the modern day. I liked it. But it was quite daft in the end.
It was ridiculous.
I will literally watch any Dracula film, TV show, anything, because it's one of my favourites. So I'll leave it there. So thank you very much, Josh.
Thank you for having me.
Podcast. It's an absolute pleasure. So, bye!
Bye.
Hey, thank you so much for listening to the end if you made it. I appreciate you, and thank you again so much to my guest this episode, Josh. Now, Josh is one of the very few young people I know that doesn't have any social media, so I'm afraid you can't go and anonymously stalk his comings and goings online. But if you do have any comments you'd like me to pass on, I would be very happy to do so. I'm sure he would love that. Now, in this episode, you may remember that we briefly mentioned handcuffs. And as we didn't know at the time, I thought I would look it up, of course. The police force, as we know it now, in England at least, in historical context is still relatively young, only really going back to the mid-1800s, about 1839. So Josh's story at the malts mill took place in the 1850s, and we wanted to know if they would use handcuffs. So they probably did have handcuffs, but from the very scant research I did, they may have used what were called Bangor handcuffs. Look them up. Look up a photo if you can. They look really awful. They basically don't allow for any hand or wrist movement, and they're sort of fastened with a bolt. Or they could have just used rope or animal hide, as Josh had said. So no solid answer there, but I just wanted to offer a little extra. Any research sources, including that of the handcuffs, can be found in the show notes of the podcast app you're using to listen today, or through the Acast page for the podcast, which should also be linked on any app that you're using to listen. I'll also be linking all this information to the Twitter page, and the handle is @NotHeathenLand. I would love to see you there. Come and say hi. Let's have a chat. Editing and podcast artwork credit again goes to Luke Smith. Once again, thank you for listening, and I will speak to you in the next episode. Goodbye.